the national meeting that some of us in the states are very concerned about these matters, and we've formed a group called the Committee for the Prevention of Nuclear Peace. And our motto is that since we have enough bombs and missiles to blow up the world 10 times over, a few more couldn't really hurt anything. And suggest that there's a slightly more hard-line approach down there. Our next speaker, who will address the topic, can the West defend itself, is very well qualified indeed for this discussion. He spent 35 years in the British military, retiring with the rank of brigadier, and he has a PhD in war studies from London University. He is a specialist in the topic of low-intensity warfare, which involves such things as are going on now, terrorism, psychological warfare, disinformation, and so on. He was the founder director of the Center for Conflict Studies at the University of New Brunswick, which is not in New Jersey, for those of you in the States. And he is presently researching and writing a book related to these matters, which he hopes to bring out next year. And it, too, is devoted to the subject of low-intensity warfare. Would you please welcome at this time Dr. Morris Tugwell. Mr. Tugwell?
We're going to be showing some pictures. If you want to look at them, do you want to just move slightly sideways?
I'm the reason why that thing has stood there all day. I'm also one of the Canadian speakers today, of which there have been several, one of the immigrants that do all the work. I'll start with some good news. The Medical Research Institute at McMaster University, starting next year, are not going to use rats. They're going to use civil servants. And there are two reasons advanced for this. First, there are now more civil servants in Canada than rats. And the second one is that the researchers are less likely to become emotionally involved. We're asking ourselves whether or not the West can defend itself. And right at the heart of that answer to that question was lie whether or not we have the will to defend ourselves. And so that is the aspect of defense, not whether we have enough hardware, tanks, or Star Wars equipment, but whether we have the will to defend ourselves. And the center of will is some vague thing, a matter of ideals and ideas, belief and value systems. And I'm going to try to probe into this. It's getting right off the edge of the type of hard discipline that people can actually test by measurement and weighing. And therefore you get into the area where my ideas are just about as good as yours and yours as good as mine. But I'd like to try this out on you and get your reactions, and please be critical if you don't think it stands up. The Chinese military philosopher Sun Tzu, who is frequently quoted now and rightly, remarked something to the effect that true excellence in war is not to defeat your opponent in the field. True excellence in war is to win without fighting. And this is really my side of it. Psychological warfare in the modern age, the question of destroying your enemy's will. Because that's all warfare is about, really, isn't it? To change the other man's mind. To change a will to resist into a will not any longer to resist, to make peace on your terms. And sometimes, normally, you do it after 5 years of shattering warfare when you finally won't go on any longer. And sometimes you can do it without 5 years. And we'll start then with my theory of the Trinity, if we could have that. I believe that anybody who's going to conduct anything in this world, particularly energetic things such as revolutions or taking a country into war. But even just to tick over as a country in peace, you must have these three key belief systems. And on the left at the bottom is an idea of what is good. Now, if I'm going to turn you into revolutionary force to follow me into some enormously risky business, you've got to believe intensely that the cause we are going to fight for is good. Must be, otherwise you cannot begin the operation. And then the opposite side of that coin has to be this one on the right. Those that stand between us and the achievement of that good end must represent the forces of evil. Must they not? Because they stand between us and the neutralist. So that is the evil enemy. And finally, and this is terribly important, I could have you all worked up here, believing in the good cause, furious with the evil enemy that holds us away from that good cause, but unless I can convince you that we're going to win, that we've got a damn good fighting chance of winning, you're not going to follow. Because you'd be dumb if you did. Very few people want to go out there and just get mowed down. And so the final part of this trinity is belief in victory. And I call it the inevitable victory theme. If you examine any revolutionary propaganda, and this is what I worked for on my PhD thesis, was an examination of revolutionary propaganda, those three things are central. That doesn't actually amount to the propaganda themes with which you use to advance your cause once you've got the operation going. But in order to mount, to have a movement at all, this trinity must exist. Now, let us look at a few examples of how this has been worked. In order to generate the necessary will to fight in various types of war, we have number two. Holy war. Now, in this, the religious belief is your good cause, and that provides a complete value system. It may very often be reinforced by nationalism, reinforced by a sense of resentment, envy, or whatever. And of course, what I'm showing you now as religion one will in reality overlap the other ones I'm going to show you in a minute. I'm dividing them up into different segments, but in almost any real national case, you'll find them all present. But if you look back in history, I mean, certainly in European experience, up until the French Revolution, almost all wars were religious wars. Even if they were just after booty, they had to be justified on religious grounds. And so religious belief as the good system is very important indeed. And naturally the non-believer, the one who was either a heretic or a rival faith or some other unbeliever, and who really could only be put to the sword or converted, he is the evil on the right. And here the belief in inevitable victory is very strongly linked to the belief that God's will see his people to victory. Messianic beliefs, etc. The examples of that from history, I mean, if you look back at the Old Testament, that when the Jews believed that they had offended Jehovah, and no longer had God on their side, making victory inevitable, boy, they fell apart and did they suffer. Almost always attributed to this. And many other examples. So let's leave that one now and go on to number three. Nationalist war. Defense of the good way of life. The nationalist cause is not as clear-cut as a religious war, it seems to me. The good cause is the way of life that this particular country, Canada, Britain, France, whatever, may have generated. And I put at the bottom, we are better because we are what we are. That really is all I can say about nationalism. It's not a logical thing, but then none of these are. We might also say that our political and cultural ethical values are superior. And finally, that our system is a success. That's quite important. but it has to work. This is a wartime one, and the enemy threatens the good cause and must be evil. Now, before World War I, the British did not really regard the Germans as being evil, and when they went to war, it was necessary to make them so. And so British propaganda produced all these atrocity stories about the Germans, some of which were based on truth, the great largest part were not. Photographs taken in Russia during one of the programs were used to portray alleged German atrocities and all kinds of things. But that, in order to keep the two sides quite distinctly, good and evil, two very, very contrasting sides of the coin, you have to paint the enemy as the evil because he threatens your good cause. The inevitable victory theme of this trinity in nationalistic wars is very vague. And I often wonder how on earth it works as well as it does. I mean, as a youngster, aged about 13 or something, about the time of Dunkirk, it was never crossed my mind that Britain was not going to win the war. There was no logical reason for it, but victory was still inevitable because defeat was unthinkable. That is a sustaining thing. For Americans in World War II, it was unthinkable because it really was pretty well unthinkable. I mean, the relative strengths were so strong. But people will go on fighting if the nationalist feeling is strong enough, in despite an awful lot of evidence to the contrary. National self-confidence, we call that. As for the system of the enemy being successful or not, you can dismiss that out in your propaganda. If he's a very successful system, then you accuse him of being gross and overindulgent. Rather the way that envious Europeans tend to look at North America. And if he's, in fact, far beneath you, then you describe him as backward and full of envy. Number three, please. Or is that three, four? Just as an example of a freaky one, National Socialism, the good there was this extraordinary domination by a racially pure Aryan master race. That was what represented the good in that very hazy, undefined ideology of nationalism. The evil were Jews, inferior races, Bolsheviks, capitalists, very strongly capitalists, and all who resisted. And everybody had to fill, anybody who was an enemy had to be portrayed thus. German propaganda at that time always portrayed Roosevelt and Churchill and people like that as Jews. So it was German nationalism reinforced and distorted by this Nazi ideology. But it was a very powerful internal force because it got the very most out of nationalism and the very most out of that particular ideology which fanned the resentment of a Germany defeated and believing itself to be badly treated after World War. They never really thought through the national and international aspects. Only the SS had a sort of internationalist theory, which was never really put into practice. Because when they had huge surrenders of armies from the Soviets, they did not use them in a proper internationalist way and turn them around and left it too late. It was a nutty system, but extraordinarily dynamic. Extraordinarily dynamic. And the inevitable victory theme seemed to work on this national socialist dynamic, the thousand-year Reich. Nothing logical. But then there is nothing logical in any of these. But they're very, very strong in spite of that. Okay. Now, democracies at peace. What we're dealing with now, we're getting into the problem of Lenin's permanent struggle. We are dealing with a problem with the Soviet Union, where there is neither peace nor war. Ever since Lenin militarized politics, he presents a threat which is on a par, but without the violence of war. And it has many of the characteristics of war as we understand it, and yet it is not declared war. And therefore the West does not respond And we are very often, I mean, this is not any particular Western country, nor at any particular time. That might be Britain in 1936, might be the United States today, I don't know. But you can, you know how you fill those things. Ours is a good way of life. Fair enough, we're good enough, but we're not worked up about it, militant or anything, nor should we be, but the thing, that we're not an ideological society. Their system, the sort of evil people, they may sometimes be evil, but they should recognize, and surely they will realize in time, and Gorbachev, after all, the nice chap, and he's trying to remodel Soviet Union along our lines because he recognizes we're already better. And all these various other thoughts, but they vary from time to time. The efforts which were made by peace movement in Britain in the late 1930s to portray National Socialist Germany as not being almost identical to the efforts being done now by the peace movement to, you know, portray the Soviet Union. I would say myself, and this is open to debate, that within the democracies, nationalism is still the number one component problem. But political values are very important. After all, World War II could only be fought by a coalition led by America with Britain and lots of other Western countries in it. Not on a coalition could not really use any one nationality as its
it had to have
the thing. So we use freedom, democracy, and I think I'm right in saying that's really the first time that the West has used a sort of quasi-ideological mobilizing force to represent the good, and it stayed with us. And so, to a very large extent, we mobilize ourselves now around these political theories, as well as just simply saying we're Americans and we're best, we're Canadians, we're best, we're British, French, German, whatever. But still, I still believe that when the chips are down, nationalism pops right up. And material success is an unknown factor, but it's important. I mean, material success, we all know, taken too far, we get what the objective was telling us about this morning. And so it's not always good for a sort of state of national mobilization. And religion, whether it's going up or going down, you know, as a force in the world, it's certainly going up in some parts, but in the democracies, that's quite good. As for what we think of the enemy, there's many, many views. I've just thrown in a couple. There's this famous thing that if we don't threaten them, if we don't stop provoking them, well, and this other very dangerous one. When they are weak and we tell ourselves that they don't pose a threat, which we did up till about the end of the 1960s, and then we say to ourselves, oh my God, they're all strong now, we better negotiate. As for inevitable victory, well, of course, without a war, in an ordinary peacetime situation, and since none of, outside of this room almost nobody recognizes the fact that there is an ongoing struggle, whether we like it or not, this is not about liking, we don't understand the need. We have a vague idea of muddling through. The good way of life deserves to survive and therefore somehow will. And that is, I suppose, a factor of the optimism of the West because we've made our system work, as David said just now, because we have managed to use the nuclear weapons ready to economize on defense and to enormously increase our GNP and have a great, overall, a great success in the West. But for all that, it's a pretty hazy thing, and without the Soviet Union to threaten us, it's a system which you and I like. We don't want societies to be militarized and all worked up and thinking of themselves, you know, xenophonic and everything else. But given the Sun Tzu situation, it could be rather a fun one. Can we have the next? Now, the way the communists look at this is rather different. On the good side, you have international communism being good. It is, as they say in the manifesto, heaven on earth, and it represents the future. On the other hand, there are class enemies, that's you and me, and it really means these days anybody who resists communism. And of course, we're called capitalists, imperialists, and counter-revolutionaries, and anything else. Our resistance, and this is quite clear, I mean, communist theory, those who resist are aggressors. This goes back to Marx, never mind Lenin. So the act of resisting communism is a form of aggression. That's why all communist wars are defensive. And of course, we're defending the past. this tremendously strong factor, Marx's greatest legacy, in my opinion, to the Marxist-Leninist operating family, is this business of historical determinism. Because that theory, that history, inside of a change and it's inevitable, and the party has a duty to hasten it, and the party can manipulate it and make it work, it is, in fact, the sort of both. The party is both the servant and the master of history. John Lenchowski did a very nice piece in which he worked out that that really makes the party into God, which is a nice, interesting theory. That is, I think, of all the sort of propaganda assets, the most important. It's very, very important, particularly as forgotten the name, the chef who wrote Nomenklatura, Michael Boslenski, as he points out, that inevitable victory thing is very good for keeping the Soviet people and all the people in the captive states in a state of helplessness and hopelessness. It's not necessarily believed by the leadership anymore, but it's a tremendously useful propaganda weapon. If you feel that, you know, that there's really no hope because history has gone this way and whatever's going to happen is going to go, you don't revolt. It knocks the guts out of you. And I would say that an awful lot of people in the West are beginning to feel that. Trudeau believed that. One of the things that Trudeau picked up from the LSE when he worked there, way back, for sure, that he's always believed in historical materialism, even if he hasn't accepted the entire mishmash. And Marxist-Leninist ideology provides this complete value system. Now, the fact that it's no longer believed by most people in the Soviet Union, probably including a lot of their leaders, does not deprive it of its operational value, because it is a discipline of a thought system that confines the agenda and keeps people marching in the right direction. Very, very useful thing. Lots and lots. There's a lot of French philosophers who had lost their faith in the Catholic Church. Nevertheless, you can still like to go to church because the liturgy is very important. It's comforting and it keeps them thinking in a certain way. The same sort of thing. But when under stress, it will be reinforced by nationalism and by religion, anything you like. You probably read Tolstoy's books and how when the Germans hit them in 41, I mean, the thing just collapsed. And they had to abandon it for 3 or 4 years. They never used the word Soviet, they never used the word communist, nothing. It was Mother Russia, and the church was dragged up out of the gutter of major support. So, you know, it isn't actually a very good system. It's nothing like as efficient as National Socialism. I fought Germany at the end of the war. It was unbelievable. Until that last radio shut down, they still believed it. But these people are just shattered under the impact. And at the end of the war, they were in a hell of a state, so, you know, psychological state. Awful. One of the reasons for the Iron Curtain was that they're totally unreliable. And it's never been half as good as we imagine. It's only really effective outside the Soviet Union. But they've got such an apparatus of making it work that they just hold it together. I think it's much more vulnerable. That's why I like to hear Morton Blackwell saying we ought to get back at them, because this is the opportunity. The evil enemy poses a threat because he displays an attractive alternative. That is also what Michael Kosinski says. That they don't believe in this anymore, but they know, the nomenclatura, that they're going to lose it all unless they can eliminate that bright spark, that flame, which still exists somewhere out there. And when Westerners go on these exchange visits and prance around in the Soviet Union or in East Europe, being polite to their Communist Party hosts and that sort of thing, they are traitors to those poor sods who are captives there, because they are demonstrating the treachery of the West and diminishing their play. Okay, that was the last one. No, just now. Could we go back to number one? Yes. Now, in all wars, until we got to the age of revolutionary wars, it was in fact very difficult to get at the enemy's concept of good and evil. I mean, there were various exceptions. In the American War of Independence, which was of course revolutionary anyway, the British used a lot of mercenaries known as Hessians. And one of the first acts of the Continental Congress was to offer bribes, really, very good psychological war, for Hessians to come across and desert the British, of course, and fight for the revolution. And they had tracts of land and that sort of thing according to their rank. So you can knock on. I mean, that was really attacking the good. They were going to the Hessians. They said, look, you're not fighting for the right side. Come across. But apart from exceptional things like that, where there are mercenaries who can't have any of these things because they're just hired guns. Generally speaking, our experience in wars has not been very good at getting at the other side's basic values. It hasn't been very successful. You know, massive amounts of propaganda has poured out, very, very poor results. There have been the odd, I mentioned the Old Testament thing. There's also the one in, nice one, in 1066. This is a theory of one historian. When Harold knew that William was coming after him across the Channel, he also heard, to his horror, that the Pope had backed William. And so his legitimacy as leader of his army, once his troops got to hear this, that he'd been excommunicated, was zero. And the theory is that he met, instead of withdrawing inland and allowing William to stretch his line of communication, then hitting him at the right time and right place from Harold's point of view, he rushed out and fought him on the beach practically and lost. Because he knew that if the news got down, that the inevitable victory thing was no longer there, all would be lost. It's an interesting theory. Came back rather long time. In 1918, right at the very end, British and American psychological warfare against the Germans worked, and it worked only on that top one, inevitable victory, because they simply had done it. They'd had that tremendous success in March, they'd overrun the French and British, and they'd found all the trenches were stocked with goodies, and they were starving, and that was actually quite bad for them. And then when in August the counterattack came with the Americans and everybody else, they just knew they couldn't win, and the combination then of empirical evidence of the impossibility of victory, combined with good propaganda pointing it out and making surrender and that sort of thing possible, did produce quite a collapse in the German army. And it was the inevitable victory one, not their values. They didn't change their values. So that has always been the target, really, of psychological warfare until recently. Look out for that, incidentally, in Iraq. I believe that the time has come when the Iranians, if they're good, to persuade the Iraqis that they can't win, but I'm not sure. Okay, so we get then to the revolutionary situations. And essentially, revolution is different from war between states because it is internal. And it is conversion, not wiping out. You're not battering away from the outside, you're working from the inside. What you're trying to do is to change people's perceptions of good and evil.
You got more eggs to
add. I am now a revolutionary leader, and I'm trying to persuade you as uncommitted people. I've got to persuade you that, in fact, it is me, the rebel, that is good, and the government that is evil. And switch your opinions which you've had since birth. And that is how revolutions work. And it is a combination of physical and psychological actions that we see with terrorism, we see with full-scale revolution. It's all about allegiance and changing people's allegiance. And as soon as you've changed enough and the correlation of forces on your side, then the top one, inevitable victory, is yours. But you work on inevitable victory right from the start by trying to make sure that you only attack the enemy at places where you're going to have an easy, cheap victory. Never go for a massive attack of enemies. So you constantly show the government forces to be incapable of defeating them. It's always you who is winning. They're always blundering into ambushes and so on. And so this concept of inevitable victory comes across to your side as long as well as this vital thing that you are on the right side. And that's a very complicated thing, and I'd like to talk about that some other time. But it's changed everything when you get into a revolutionary type of war. And now I will tell you, of course, which is part of this, and you know it, that the type of war we are involved in with the Soviets is revolutionary war on the global scale. It is not old-fashioned interstate war. And most people don't recognize it anymore at all. But it is an international version of revolutionary warfare. And so for the first time, really, that I can trace, and I haven't given an awful lot of research on this, I can't think of a previous occasion when the basic value systems of the West have been under attack in the way that they are now. It's not just an American picture that they're going after. In fact, that is the last one. It is our estimation of the goodness of our own society, our own values, and our estimation of the evilness of the Soviet Union. Now, can we have the very last one? I mean, this is just a complete guess, but it's something to think about. I believe this is the sort of situation in the democracies that Moscow would like to engender. And on the left, I mean, this is the way they like us to think of our own society. That ours is a selfish, immoral, materialistic, eccentric way of life. There has to be something better out there. Okay, we're back to what Midge was talking about. Extreme relativism, social criticism, guilt transfer, domestic tensions, uncontrolled immigration, terrorism, subversion, all this progressive education, loss of national identity, disinformation, wishful thinking, fear, ignorance, and all these kinds of things could create that sort of feeling. And then you look against the Soviet Union and you say, well, how can we criticize when we are no good anymore? And you get into this business of the see no evil, hear no evil, think no evil. And right at the top there, you begin to get the erosion of the inevitable victory, or at least the reasonable degree of confidence that we normally maintain in peacetime. The war is too dangerous, better red than dead. Our survival now depends upon doing a deal and doing it quickly. And it'll be. Because if we don't leave that the Soviet Union is ready even, then we've nothing to lose in doing that deal quickly. Now if you look back to the Vietnam conflict, it was carried out perfectly. Just perfect. I don't know if you know an author called Gunter Lewy. I've just completed editing a big volume on deception. It's called Deception East-West Relations. It'll be out, I hope, next year. And he did the chapter on some deceptions in Vietnam. And it's a beautiful piece and it's a great eye-opener. And when you look at it, they destroyed America's view of its right to be fighting that war. They had this marvelous deception based on the NFL, which was really a front. And the NFL people themselves were taken in and deceived by the North Vietnamese. They were genuine, a lot of them non-communist nationalists. The NFL was presented to the American population as being a freedom-fighting organization with no communist links, and therefore that deprived America of all its legitimacy for fighting the war. And then we had the whole series of attacks on American morale based on the theory that America was conducting a genocide. You had the now this is throwing people in fighting the traps. So the first talk of throwing people out of airplanes in the interrogation appeared in Izvestia 2 years before it first surfaced in the West. And then, of course, it immediately surfaced the war crime tribunal. And then you get all this copy of this inside the United States, the soldiers went to trial, all these things. By the end of that, America thought nothing of the situation. I'm afraid that's the same. So, you know, our side was no good, had no right to be fighting. And then you had, towards the end, going to Hanoi in large numbers and came back and said that, you know, they're going to be all right. There's no problem. They're going to guarantee, and the whole business of the deception of the Paris agreements, they're going to guarantee they will not wish to take over the South. The South can be democratic. It can do what it likes. You know, all they want is a democratic peace and everything else. And all these people came back and spread the message that there was nothing to fear from the North. And that, you know, we'd made a gross effort. And of course, inevitable victory went down the drain as soon as, I mean, the only genuine thing which the genuine Americans who wanted to stop the war for good reasons patriotic Americans and their friends abroad saw the thing perhaps could not be won by the method and under the circumstances which had been called. That was a legitimate means. They'd seen that inevitable victory had turned to inevitable stalemate, and there was something to be got out of it. So that was really the first thing to crumble. But of course that crumbled completely once left and right had changed. So, it was a nice example, horrible example, but nice from an academic point of view, of this revolutionary technique in action. And, you know, it's a very important lessons to learn, seems to me, out of all this. Because this is exactly the same war we are now fighting writ large. Perhaps we go back to number one again, so we're not got these distractions. What we have today is a kind of repeat, a rerun of the Vietnam War writ large. And it, I hope it's not going to work. I'm not one of these terrible pessimists. I don't think that everything's going to fall apart. But I do think it's important that we recognize the significance of all this. This again is our view. And the methods being used are the communist parties in the West, which are tiny but provide that vital organizational framework. And they work like steam. I mean, we got on film, I don't know if the Americans here have seen Kit Vincent's film called The Deception Network, which was shown on CTV here in Canada. So far he hasn't got an American network with enough guts to show it. But it's marvelous. In it, Michael Mayerson, who heads the American Peace Congress, in Congress, of course, business law around Moscow, openly admits, and is proud of the fact that his organization totally organized that huge rally in Central Park at the time of UNSCOT II. Having previously denied it, and the FBI couldn't prove it, he says they tried to prove it, they couldn't. I'll tell you now, we did it. So don't underestimate the organizational power of communists, even if there's only half a dozen of them. And then there's the fronts, the people who are controlled by communists indirectly. And there's this, what I call fraudulent third worldism, of which we've heard a lot today. There's the peace movement, which is easily their most powerful weapon now. Because what the peace movement does more than anything is to reverse these two images, good and evil. Peace movement totally goes against America. And not only does it attack American arms in a sort of pragmatic way, say they must go, it, in the end, declares America to be a warmonger. It doesn't take, I mean, this is even, I'm not talking about the radical end of it, I'm talking about mainstream peace movement, says that America is preparing for a nuclear war. Over and over and over again, it wants a nuclear war. This is the end to which America is looking, a nuclear war. So America then, instead of being the good, becomes the evil. And as for this, the peace movement's commitment to denying the evil of the Soviet Union is utter. Because in fact, the whole peace movement's propaganda, the whole sort of ideology of peace, I'm not talking about the hardline communist ideology, I'm talking about the softer line ideology which peace movements in the West have developed. That entire framework of thinking falls apart if the reality of the Soviet Union is recognized. And the reality of the Soviet definition of peace, which of course is the same as Soviet victory. And so I think peace movement is really their strongest thing. And of course, inevitable victory is eradicated because there can be no victory. By concentrating on the horrors of nuclear war and denying the existence of the war without fighting, Sun Tzu's war, all resistance is lost. The argument goes like this, that nuclear war is the end of the world because of the nuclear winter, etc. Any kind of war, a limited war in Europe or whatever, is almost certain to lead to a nuclear war, so we're back to the end. Any kind of resistance, really, is going to lead sooner or later to war. And that's going to lead to nuclear war, it's going to lead to the end of the war. So there must not be any resistance. And therefore we get back to what we saw earlier, let's negotiate on any terms. I'm slightly simplifying, not much. I'm going straight to it. If you really analyze all these statements, that's what it comes down to. In Canada, neutral Canada, out of NORAD, out of NATO, and into total neutrality, which is undefended neutrality, defenselessness. And within the United States, it's a rather more difficult thing. There is a pretense under the things like the freeze movement, pretense of neutral thing, but it's not really. It's, you know, difficult for one-sided disarmament. So peace is very important. Terrorism, which, I mean, it's interesting that the International Department of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union controls both international terrorism and the international peace movement. And, of course, in Soviet terms, there's no contradiction. It's all part and parcel of the same thing. And terrorism is now, I think, a serious matter. I mean, you know, it's a rather gross thing to say. 5,000 people killed in the last 15 years. And we have not yet reacted at all. Nothing really. I mean, there was the American reaction in Tripoli, which was one thing. Very little serious reaction. And there are things which can be done. I mean, I do think that the countries might be ready to come to an agreement that reinstate the death penalty for terrorists who commit murder. Out of 430 terrorists which have been picked up, this is about 10 years ago in Europe, something all but about six have been released as a result of terrorist hostage taking. And now I don't know what the figures are for the Middle Eastern terrorists. They're all getting out again. And I don't know how long France will stand up to this. If those guys were dead, we wouldn't have that. So I think as a matter of absolute operational necessity, these guys have got to be killed. I mean, one way of doing it is the sort of SAS way, is you just don't take prisoners. You can't afford to do that, unfortunately. It's a very good way. And I think you've got to have a system of summary courts and death sentences. It's not a popular sort of thing to raise. And the other thing is, Iran, Syria, and Libya, in that order of awfulness, are the sponsors of most of this Middle Eastern terrorism, which is now linked up with Action Directe and the Red Brigade. Red Brigades have suddenly got into the international terrorism business, having been rather localized, and with the Red Army faction. And you've got now this anti-Western Arab come radical European movement, and it is thoroughly directed. And unless we say, and I don't know whether you could ever get the Allies to agree, or say, right, cut off all relations with those three countries, cut off all flights to them completely, and cut off all deals with them, and make them suffer, I don't think they're going to stop. I was at a conference in England last week, and somebody, and I'm trying to get this documented, had heard at a conference in East Europe, one of the East Europeans say, we're going to turn your part of the world into another level. And that is what they are doing now in Europe. And I agree with that assessment we had this afternoon, that they're probably leaving America just now because it's easier to deal with one at a time. And not to. They've always been terrified of the awakening of America. They don't want a Pearl Harbor. They know what happened after Pearl Harbor. They'd like America to stay like this. Oh, it's in British and it's all their own fault. You know, it's different out there. We're okay. And finally, I guess, from this morning's thing, you can add to all that the crisis of capitalism. If you look at the history of the 1930s during the Depression, you had this enormous pilgrimage of all the West European, particularly intellectuals, to Moscow, because the failure of capitalism had convinced them that there had to be something much better in socialism. And they all went there, and they all found it. At the very time of the very worst of the Stalinist successes, they came back and praised the tremendous success of the Soviet experiment. You know, if you begin to lose faith in your own side, you will find the New Jerusalem in the other. And so if we're going to face a serious economic capitalism, that's going to add to another problem. Now, I don't want to be all miserable. Let's go back to the communist one, shall we? And I'll finish. I just believe that there's one way to lose a war, and that is not to fight it. And if the other side is going to fight a war we don't want, we better recognize the fact that we have to do it. And of course, you're up against exactly that problem of the State Department and all other foreign official communities, is that they don't like the acceptance of the fact that the world is not conducted on a diplomatic plane. They don't like to accept the existence of the International Department as being the controlling influence, and that the foreign ministry in Soviet Union is subordinate. They don't like the idea of party struggle, which is what it is. It's not interstate. Party ideological revolutionary struggle. It's quite different. And they're not trained for it. They don't understand it. It throws them into a sort of a horror. All this is vulnerable as hell. And I think that the state of the Soviet Union now is something which causes Gorbachev and others a hell of a lot of worry. And I think that we could, you know, encourage that worry and give them some good grounds for it. And that is another discussion period. In fact, it's another whole seminar. And some years ago, I did do some seminars like this, and I had some influence down south. And it was very encouraging. I mean, I think what this administration in Washington has done, with all the difficulties of working in the Western atmosphere when we're not supposed to recognize the fact that the war going on, has been excellent. The strengthening of the radios and the strengthening of the tone and the quality of broadcasting have been terrific. It has not been what I and others think is sufficient, and it hasn't yet got right through to all the allies. But this business of recognizing this aspect, if you think that my theory of the Trinity is right, I think it's vital to not only our ability to defend ourselves, but our ability to survive. Thank you.